This is quite a day. It's the first day of summer. Actually, I think it started a few days ago, but today is officially the first day of summer, so the days are going to start getting shorter. It's my 10th anniversary here. It's Father's Day, of course, and I want to wish a happy Father's Day to all of you who qualify, and that includes not just biological fathers, but stepfathers, uncles, grandfathers, male friends, even single mothers who have to play both roles. I know some of you do that. That's the toughest job of all, I think, and I honor you for it. Even in this politically correct era of equality between the sexes and avoidance of stereotypes of any kind, when most of us hear the word father, it brings up a very specific picture in our mind, and that picture in our mind is based on everything from our own individual experiences with our own father figure, whatever that happened to look like, to the movies and the TV shows that we watched when we were growing up. Maybe we watched Father Knows Best or The Cosby Show. Maybe we got it off The Simpsons or Married with Children, you know, completely different father images. But all of those images that we have personally collected are then superimposed on our common joint collective belief on our race consciousness going back thousands of years about what a father is supposed to be, what a father is supposed to do or not do, how a father should interact with his children. And some parts of that mental image have changed substantially over the years, while other parts, the images of what a father is and does and all that, haven't changed at all. My own father made his transition in 1986, 23 years ago, but I can remember him like it's yesterday. I've got a picture of him on my dresser. I see him first thing every morning when I wake up. And he was a wonderful man, and I do know that I loved him very much. I remember that. But I also realized from these years that I didn't really know him very well, and I think a lot of us find that out as we get older. Everybody liked my father. He was just one of those likable, friendly people, but the best part of it was I liked him too. Now, my parents had a fairly conventional 1950s kind of a relationship growing up. It wasn't quite Ozzie and Harriet, but it was that kind of a thing, which means my father worked full-time outside the home, and my mom took care of the house and the five kids. So my father worked from 8 to 5, and my mom worked from 8 till 8 the next morning, and then started all over again with no time off. My father also had his own unique way of communicating. I mean, my father, personality-wise, you remember the movie An Officer and a Gentleman, Louis Gossett? Well, my father actually did that for a living. He was a drill instructor with these people, so he was this very strong military with this loud, piercing voice. But he had his own way of communicating. He'd say one thing, and if you knew him well enough, you'd realize that he meant something completely different. For example, when my father was working on some project out in the yard and it didn't seem to be going very well, my mother would stand there and ask him if he knew what he was doing. And my father would look up as if he'd been insulted, and he would tell her, "Don't bother me, this is a guy thing," which really meant, "No, I don't know what I'm doing, but I would rather die than admit it." Okay? Or whenever one of us kids asked him a question about science or something or how something worked, and he said it'd take too long to explain, that meant that he didn't know how it worked either, and he didn't want to tell us. Now, when he was inside the house, it worked the same way. Whenever he asked my mom, "Can I help out with dinner?" what he was saying is, "When is dinner going to be ready?" You know, that's the translation. Or when he said to her, "You know, honey, why don't you take a break? You're working too hard." What he was saying was, "I can't hear the football game with the vacuum cleaner running." So that's why. So, you know, once you broke the code, he was easy to understand. He was also, anybody else have a father like that? That must be a universal thing, I guess. He was also, as anyone who knew him would tell you, a generous, warm, loving, and very funny man who would give the shirt off his back to help someone that he didn't even know. He would start spontaneous conversations with the janitor, with a street person, with the waiter or waitress at the restaurant we were at, as easily as he would with a next door neighbor. When someone asked for help, he never said no. He would do anything for his children. One time he fell halfway down a tree, almost to the ground, and banged himself up pretty good, trying to build a tree house for us. I remember that one. When I was very small and we were living in Detroit, in the middle of these freezing Detroit days, he'd get up before dawn, and he'd run the hose on the lot next door so we'd have an ice skating rink when we woke up. Out in the water would freeze out there. He was the leader of my Cub Scout pack, you know, that cute little blue uniform with the hat that I wore. And he refereed my Little League games, so that was fun. He was at my graduation, my Air Force Academy graduation, and because he was a retired Navy chief, 20 years in the Navy, after graduation, he was the first person to salute me when I got commissioned as an Air Force officer, and we were both crying like babies, you know, it was kind of a thing. So he worked hard, and he took care of his family every day of his life, and I was very lucky to have him as my father. Now, the reason I bring this up is not to brag about my dad, which I'm always happy to do, and it's not just to get you thinking about your own childhood experiences with your father, because I know not everyone is lucky enough to have the memories as good as the ones I have, though many of you do. The reason I bring this up, whether your memories are good or not so good, is to show how powerful and emotional our feelings can be when we're talking about the person who played the father role in our own life. Because our relationship with our father is very different from the relationship that we had with our mother that I talked about on Mother's Day. We were actually born out of our mother's body, and we were probably very close to her emotionally, but if not emotionally, at least physically, for the first few years of our life. But our father, in some respects, was kind of an outside authority figure. He wasn't around all the time. For many of us, he'd disappear in the morning and he'd show up later on in the evening. He had a loud voice. His face was kind of rough and scratchy, except first thing in the morning when it was smooth and it smelled kind of good with whatever he had. I think Aquavelva, that's what my father used. All right. And for many of us, as we got older, he was the one that was more occupied, more connected to the outside world. Once again, this was in the 50s, remember. And it seemed like sometimes there were other things in his world that were more important than us kids, whether it was the mortgage or the job or whatever it was. But we didn't question it. We just accepted his role because that's what fathers do. That's what we were taught. Now, before I take this any farther, I also want to point out that over the last 30 years or so, this stereotype has changed quite a bit, with the work roles changing and more women having careers, fathers staying more involved with the kids, the Mr. Mom, that kind of a thing, staying home, and all that's good. And the number of children being raised in single-parent families by fathers or mothers has increased a lot, too. But long before the days of Mr. Mom, there was something that happened many, many years ago, back when the role of the mother and the father were much more clearly defined by society. Something happened that is affecting all of us today. And when I say us, I don't just mean you and me or the people in this room. I'm talking about the big us. I'm talking about people everywhere in the world. It's something that happened for perfectly logical reasons that I'll talk about in a few minutes, but it has had an unanticipated, profound, and in many ways negative effect on how a great number of us understand and express our relationship to our spiritual nature. In some respects, it's even limited the world's ability to achieve a deep understanding of what this creative intelligence, this life force that we call God that flows through us is all about. And what I'm talking about is the way in which many of the great spiritual traditions of the world, especially the Western spiritual traditions that many of us grew up in, have unconsciously constructed our idea of what God is and does and should do by using the cultural images and characteristics of a human father from 2,000 years ago. And as a result of this strange blend of spirituality and cultural history, what we have ended up with is a fairly large number of people, many of them well-educated, many of them not, who have completely accepted an image of God as a male authority figure with supernatural powers who created us for his own reasons and whose job now is to protect, to judge, to reward, or to punish us. And the list of problems that that one simple spiritual misconception has caused and continues to cause is absolutely mind-boggling. Wars, sexism, genocide, religious persecution, homophobia, poverty, and more, all aggravated by this one unfortunate belief. Now, fortunately, we seem to be slowly evolving out of that old, outdated idea into a more powerful and rational belief of God as life itself, as of God as this creative presence that actively and unconditionally supports everyone everywhere in expressing life in whatever way we choose to express it. And that's good, because not only is this uncorrupted truth what the teacher Jesus and the Buddha and all the great spiritual teachers throughout history were telling us, that's exactly what they were telling us. It's this new and greater understanding that's one of the greatest gifts of this teaching and teachings like it. Now, historically, it's pretty easy to see how this idea of a Father God came about. You know, I kind of like spiritual history, so bear with me for a minute or two. In one of my favorite book, actually, of Deepak Chopra's that many people have not read and don't know about, it's entitled How to Know God, okay? And in this book, Chopra talks about how every religion or spiritual tradition, either the Eastern or the Western, had its origin in one of three places. Either it came from the earth, it came from the sky or the heavens, or it came from the prevailing culture, or some combination of these. Now, the first religions to spread were the earth religions. These are the ones that were adopted by the hunters and the gatherers, the farmers, and most of these were based on the idea of a mother earth, the Gaia principle, because plants and animals came from the earth just like a child came from a mother. In these traditions, the power of life was seen as feminine, as fertile, as nurturing, all right? So they built statues and they prayed to goddesses in the early, early years. But later, as the world started to move, as trade and travel and these things started to increase and the world became smaller, people became more interested in the heavens, in the sky. They lived by the sun. It was the only light they had. They followed the stars to navigate. They started seeing pictures in the stars, the constellations that we see even today. And they were awed by the shapes and the forms that they saw in the face of the moon. So they started to see their gods as being up there, so up there. And that created a separation between human beings and God, or what we believe were the powers that controlled the destiny of human beings and the planet. But when civilization began to expand even further, and kings and countries wanted to find a way to claim that spiritual authority, to control it for themselves, they had to find a way to connect with the god or the gods that were up there. So they created stories of these gods who actually came down to earth and interacted with their chosen people, who coincidentally happen to be the same people who were making up the stories, okay? Funny as that is, okay? We see this in Judaism, we see it in Islam. All right. Now, in some of their stories about the gods and how they came down and how they interacted with their chosen people, those stories became their mythology. Some of these gods even went so far as to descend and to have children with mortals. This was in Hinduism, Buddhism, it's in Christianity. If you think about it, that's what the story of the Immaculate Conception is all about. But in virtually every case, that only meant male gods coming down to visit female mortals. Because in most cultures, men were in power, so that meant the top god, the one with the most power, had to be a man. And since we mere mortals couldn't possibly be equals with God, the most reasonable assumption that they could make was that we must be his creations, which meant we must be his children. Now, from there, from that point, it was easy to create a spiritual culture based more and more strongly on the idea of one supreme being made in the image and the likeness of a powerful, arbitrary, judgmental, sometimes generous, occasionally merciful, but frequently angry father figure. In other words, it was convenient for them to create a god who was just like the father figure that most people were familiar with, because that sort of a god, that system was easy to justify and easy to administer because the lines of authority were very clear, boss, kids, father, kids. It kept questions to a minimum because people who asked questions were punished. And most important of all, it kept certain people under control. particularly women, minorities, slaves, the people that they wanted to be disenfranchised. Now, if we look at the way that society everywhere has evolved from the beginning, all of this makes perfect sense, because this concept of God is based on a certain view of the world. It's based on a view of the world as a dangerous place where disease and war and poverty and suffering are all part of the normal process of human life. Back then, people felt powerless and helpless, so what they wanted was a protector. They wanted someone that they could pray to, that they could turn to when they were scared. Not only that, they wanted a personal God they could understand and identify with. I mean, life was complicated enough, so all most of them wanted was a simple set of rules and someone to explain them, just like they had when they were children. Now, the downside is you end up being afraid sometimes of this kind of God, and you don't understand everything that he's doing, but at least then they could be clear about how they were supposed to behave and maybe even have some idea about why rewards and punishments went to certain people. So the idea of a decision-making father figure in charge of it all was a perfect fit. In exchange for their unquestioned obedience, they got a few nice breaks in the world if they were lucky, and a guaranteed place with their benevolent Father in heaven when they died. That was the system. Now, that was a perfectly logical way of thinking when we look at the level of spiritual understanding that existed at the time, thousands of years ago. But in some ways, spirituality is a lot like science or technology, because they all function through basic principles that are knowable and unchanging, which means as our spiritual understanding increases, and it increases across the spectrum as each one of us raises our own spiritual understanding, we have to grow and expand with it. Because if we don't, we're going to find ourselves unable to move to a higher level of living. We'll remain stuck in our old way of thinking. We'll stay stuck in this mentality of my God can beat up your God, which is exactly what's going on in the Middle East today, and that doesn't do any of us any good at all. That's why our individual and collective intelligence, by which I mean our ability to think and to reason and to make balanced decisions, has to be constantly included as a part of our spiritual awareness. We shouldn't have to turn off our brain when we're connecting with the spiritual power that we call God. The truth is, as everyone in this room is aware, I'm preaching to the choir, so to speak, or else you wouldn't be here, there has been and continues to be a shift, a quantum shift in spiritual thinking all over the planet. Now, it's not with everyone, but it's happening everywhere. This more open way of thinking and believing about spiritual matters in a more rational and scientific way has been around for a long, long time, since Socrates and even before him, all the way back 4,500 years ago to the Hindu Vedas. But it started becoming even more and more visible and to be communicated more widely in the early 1800s with Emerson and the Transcendentalists, and today it seems to be accelerating. Now, this way of thinking is not just a rejection of the old dualistic separation idea of God the Father being up there while we're down here, and it's not just a shift to the Eastern religions either, like Taoism and Buddhism, whatever, that focus on God as this impersonal presence. It's all of that, but it's more. What we are going through today, individually and collectively with centers like this, is a spiritual evolution. It's a spiritual evolution that includes all of the mental and spiritual and scientific wisdom that we have accumulated up until now, combined in a way that shows how what we used to call the physical world and the spiritual world are actually more closely intertwined than we once thought. Not only that, we are beginning to realize how important a part of this universe we are. We're discovering that our consciousness matters. Our consciousness affects the world. Or as Dr. Holmes once said in describing this teaching, he said, what we are seeing here is a correlation of the laws of science, the opinions of philosophy, and the revelations of religion applied to human needs and the aspirations of all. In other words, our consciousness matters to God because our consciousness is a reflection of God. That's where we're going right now. But the ultimate effectiveness of this way of thinking as something that can not only improve our individual lives, but also begin to heal all of the chaos that's going on in the world today, the effectiveness of this way of spiritual thinking will not be realized until we accept, both individually and as a race, that spirit or God or the power of life or whatever term we use is not someone or something that we have to satisfy, worship, or appease. It is what we are. It is what we are. Now, we're not all of it any more than the wave is all of the ocean, but we're made of the same stuff. We function and create in the same universe. We work within the same laws, and we create the same way from thought to thing. That's what we talk about here. So we are God as consciousness expressing itself uniquely as us. You are God expressing in the world as you. I am this power expressing in the world as me. And together, we are this power expressing itself as the world. Of course, there are some people who still are not willing or not able to make this leap, to make this shift, which is perfectly understandable. Because there's a certain appeal to believing that there is a cosmic sugar daddy up there. There's something in us that kind of likes that, who's going to take care of us even when we don't take care of ourselves. But that's not the way it works. It's not the way it works. We teach here that God, this power, is impersonal. And if that word sounds a little cold to you, then use the word impartial. It means it doesn't have favorites. It doesn't have any chosen people. I mean, personally, I find it very refreshing to be dealing with a power that's understandable, to be connected with a power that I know is going to work with me the same way that I work with it. I like not waking up in the morning wondering what mood God is in today. I really like, you know, that feeling. I like knowing that it always listens, not with ears, but because it is the consciousness that I am expressing with. I like that it doesn't make mistakes, that it works through laws, it doesn't go on trips, and it never sleeps. I mean, that's more than you can expect from Bill Cosby, Robert Young, and Ward Cleaver all rolled into one, you know, when you're talking about fathers. Now, it's amazing to some people, even people who have been studying metaphysics for years, how quickly their spiritual growth accelerates when they truly stop thinking of God as someone they are dealing with and begin feeling God as something that they are constantly expressing. Now, they don't know that they're thinking in a limited way. You know, when they talk about the God within, and we hear that, what they're talking about is this 6-inch tall guy sitting on a throne right here, and they talk to it the same way they talk to the God on the throne when it was up there. That's not a change of consciousness. That's just a change of venue, okay? You're looking here instead of there. We have to start seeing God as a process, as a principle rather than a personality, because that one simple shift, that one simple step, which is the first and most important step in shifting to this new thought, ancient wisdom perspective that we talk about here, that one shift makes everything different. It immediately shifts the focus from out there to right here, where the power is now and where it has always been. Instead of trying to get some unpredictable God to do what we want him to do, what it does is it causes us to focus on directing this willing power to do through us whatever we want it to do, limited only by what we are willing to allow it to do and what we are willing to accept. Those are the limitations. What will we allow the universe to do through us, and what are we willing to accept? Now, we are told, many of us grew up, I know many of you grew up in Christian teachings, and we are told that the teacher Jesus said, "It is not me, but the Father in me that doeth the work, that does all these things." Now, he's not talking, he was a very advanced mystic. He was not talking about his Father, not his earthly Father, and not his heavenly Father. He's talking about this same creative principle, the Christ consciousness, the Buddha mind, Chi, they call it in the East. It's the divine energy of which we are all made. And as we begin to understand this, and as we start taking our rightful, proper place in this wonderful creative experience that we call life, what we're going to find is that we are all fathers because we are all creators. And we are also all sons and daughters because we are all perfect manifestations of life's desire to express itself. And we are all sacred spiritual beings because spirit is all we are. It's all sacred because it's all God. This is what we need to know. This is the truth in your life. This is the truth in mine. And happy Father's Day for those to whom it applies. And so it is. And so it is. Okay. Thank you. Thank you. All right, let's take a few moments now for ourselves. Take a few breaths, roll your shoulders a little bit. Take the ideas that resonated with you. Take the thoughts that came up in your own mind. They're very powerful. And let us know together that the presence that fills us, it is in us, we are in it. We are never separated from it. We never have to go out and get it. We never have to bring ourselves to it. We are what it is. We are this power, this Father, Mother, God, this process of creation that is happening in our world all the time. It's the thoughts flowing through our mind, the love flowing through our heart, the life flowing through our veins, and the passion that flows through our soul. This is the power that created us. This is the power that gave us birth. It gave us birth out of itself. It supports us as us, and it becomes everything that we create out of the substance that we shape with our thoughts. This is what we know. So as we know this, we know that we have been given this incredible gift. We are the heirs of the one parent of which we are all both parent and child. We have been given this incredible playground of a world. We have been given this amazing mind. We have been given the ability to love and to feel. And we have been given the ability to think, to focus our consciousness in intelligent ways, to make intelligent choices, to be present in the world in an accepting, open, excited, interested, passionate way. And as we begin to do this, we begin to see the world in constant movement, and we realize that we are giving birth to our own life every single moment. We are the authority in our life every moment, our own consciousness. So as you get this thought firmly in your mind, I invite you to take a few moments, and we'll be together in silence. And in this silence, whether you see the image of your own father, or if you are a father of your children, recognize the connection of God giving birth to itself, of the father being over the child and the child being a part of the father, all together, all one. Take these few moments for yourself. With gratitude for this awareness and a clear understanding of its sacred significance in our life, we accept this truth as our own. We accept the presence of Spirit in us. We accept our responsibility and our ability to create the life we desire. We accept health, wholeness, love, abundance, all these great things that we have been given. And we give thanks with a deep appreciation for all that we have been given and all that we have yet to give. This is our truth. Knowing this completely, taking it into our consciousness, and living our life this way, we accept this and we release it, letting it be so. And so it is.